Good morning, everyone. Sorry I'm running a few minutes late today. We are going to jump back into Christianity for Modern Pagans by Peter Kraft. And we left off on page 79. We have a lighter section today, an enjoyable, thought-provoking section. But we left off on this meditation of the kind of vanity or shallowness that we all have to participate in regard to our dress, our external appearance, and the impression we give. And in one sense, it's completely unavoidable. In a positive sense, it's even a matter of stewardship and respect for the people that we represent or the people that we come into contact to. But there's also an aspect or element of vanity that Kraft points out, albeit via Pascal. So we'll jump back into that context and conversation. But first, let's have our invocation and prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, so the new material is page 79, Pensée 806. We are not satisfied with the life we have in ourselves and our own being. That's probably a line worth stopping and meditating on, isn't it? Because the dissatisfaction we have with ourselves is constant and continuous. And whether that's I want to change my appearance, or whether I want to know more, or improve in terms of discipline, or whatever else, it is simply an aspect of our fallen existence that we are never satisfied with the life we have in ourselves and our own being. And perhaps there would even be something wrong. I mean, you can argue both sides of this. There would even be something wrong about being satisfied. And I mean, sometimes, just to paint a caricature, it's like, well, I was confirmed 42 years ago. I learned it all then. I don't need to learn it all anymore. I'm completely satisfied and at peace with my spiritual development. Well, that would be a problem, not a good thing. So obviously, we're going to explore both sides, but we are not satisfied with the life we have in ourselves and our own being. And Pascal continues, we want to lead an imaginary life. Okay, now we're getting to it. An imaginary life in the eyes of others. And so we try to make an impression. Well, again, consider the opposite of this. You're just unconscious of how other people think of you. Is that a good way to go through life? I mean, that's largely, I think, perhaps in a tongue-in-cheek way, why we refer to some people as being autistic. Because autistic people actually, on the spectrum, struggle with that ability to understand their relationship, their social relationship to other people, and what's acceptable or appropriate. And then people who may not have autism, who get that label put upon them, are people who don't comprehend that there is this social dynamic in play. Or if they do comprehend it, they don't know how to negotiate it. Okay, so I think all of this is ripe for considering both sides of the coin. In any case, though, that doesn't undermine Pascal's point that we want to lead an imaginary life in the eyes of others. And so we try to make an impression. We strive constantly to embellish and preserve our imaginary being and neglect the real one. And if we are calm or generous or loyal, we are anxious to have it known, so that we can attach these virtues to our other existence. We prefer to detach them from our real self so as to unite them with the other. We would cheerfully be cowards if that would acquire us a reputation for bravery. How clear a sign of the nullity of our own being. All right, so as I've said, Pascal certainly on one side of the coin here, and yet it's poignant, and I think his argument's effective. Kraft picks up under letter A, just below. Now, this is in regard to the imaginary life we try to live in the eyes of others. He says, why, most of all, deep down, we fear damnation. Damnation is the loss of your soul, true self, image of God, real I. In this life, perhaps the closest we come to that is emptiness, hollowness, nobody there, nobody home. And of course, he's introduced that to us previously as the way that Pascal is using the term vanity, this whole section being by that very word named vanity. Crave continues, we fear we are really insubstantial ghosts deep down. All right, he's going to develop this theme that fallen human beings are deeply insecure because we feel as though we are ghosts that are just constantly wearing masks. So, got this mask or the other mask. And he's going to drive that point home in some really uncomfortable ways, you know, if you've read ahead. So Crate continues, to prove we are real, we make splashes in others' pools, especially by the two things no ghost can do, sex and violence. This is the deep unconscious source of our obsession with sex and violence. A secular society has no other way of overcoming the fear of damnation, except for diversion and indifference, the other two modern pseudo-solutions. Okay, if we skip over to page 80 and then down under point C, he says, test yourself, use Plato's thought experiment at the beginning of book 2 of the Republic. Ask yourself which you would rather be, a good soul whom everyone thought evil, hated, misunderstood, persecuted, and victimized, or an evil soul whom everyone thought good, loved, and rewarded. Would you rather be really good, but apparently evil, like Socrates? Well, I can think of a better example. How about Jesus? Or really evil, but apparently good? And isn't that Jesus' critique of the Pharisees? They're whitewashed tombs. Inside, they're really evil. Out there, goodness is just an external appearance. Okay, so really evil but apparently good, like the perfectly successful tyrant. Would you rather be brave and thought to be a coward, or cowardly but thought to be brave? All right, so some interesting considerations there, and ones that strike at the heart of the Christian life, because of course Christ is going to tell us flat out that if we follow him and are faithful to him, we are going to be persecuted and attacked by the world. Or as James puts it, friendship with God is enmity with the world. So in so many of our social / political, which are in fact religious, turmoils of our current age, your choice is to either be nice to God or be nice to people. So one example of that is, and I deal with this with my kids because they ask questions about it. What if a man thinks that he is really a woman? Well, you can be nice to that man or you can be nice to God. But there is no between because that man is saying that God made a mistake. That when God made him a biological male, he must have slipped and given him a female personality. Well, that's not something God does. And when you press on that, it's an indictment of God. And it's a damnation of what God made and a reassertion that I am God and I will make myself as I see fit. Well, you can either be nice to God who made that man, or you can be nice to that man who damns God with his beliefs about himself. But you really can't stand in the middle there. So that also then is this friendship with God, or means enmity with the world, or friendship with the world means enmity with God, that biblical principle. Okay, you have any thoughts? I thought I saw a hand or two stirring. Yes, sir.
I'm kind of questioning the original premise that, we're afraid of damnation.
I would think the stronger my faith is, the more I'm afraid of it, because I know about it, and I know the law, and I know, but for God's grace, I would be going there. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the unbeliever is clueless.
Right.
Right. So I don't know.
I think that's a great insight. Yeah, that the only ones who really fear damnation are Christians.
Yeah.
I mean, in the main, there may be exceptions to that. But in the main, we're the ones who fear God and fear his wrath and know there is a God and know the possibility. Right, where your average unbeliever, and again, we could say there are exceptions here, but your average unbeliever doesn't care about damnation, doesn't think there is a damnation, and if there is one, I'll be fine because I'm better than average. Kind of our self-perception in regard to everything, better than average. Yeah, I like your point. I think this, obviously it all is, but I think this particular section of argument on the part of Pascal and maybe especially Craved are questionable. I don't think they'd reject that, are questionable, and maybe there's better formulations or at least two sides of the coin when they're just presenting one side. So I really appreciate your thoughts there. Yes, sir.
So maybe I'm taking this out of context, but this is the flawed nature of us as humans, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So in current, psychology terminology, they would call this a people-pleasing personality.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. So what we've been taught, in theology is that we have a coram Deo before God, we live before God, and a coram mundo, we live before man. Mm-hmm. And those can coexist in a proper, ordered way. And I assume he's getting in that direction. He's going, or...
Yep, I mean, ultimately he is. In this section, he is lopsidedly focused on vanity, meaninglessness, because he, again, we're in that section that we Lutherans would call law. Mm-hmm. And this is creating silence, he's used that language, bringing up death and futility of life in order to create the silence enough that someone can be introspective and the modern pagan can realize he needs Christ. So I don't know that he's going to come rushing in with the solution to all of this in this chapter, let's say, but by the end of the book, that's ultimately where we're going to be directed.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and the difficulty, as always, I think with the nature of the subject itself, is we're dealing very vaguely with the modern pagan mindset. So your mileage may vary, the people around us, their mileage may vary, but especially as Christians, our mileage is going to vary because we're going to say, well, that's true in some ways for me, but in other ways, not so much. I mean, the question of the identity of the self is ultimately for the Christian found in God, and this is specific because, so in the same way that Christ is the capital S Son, S-O-N, and we have been made sons in him, so also Christ is the logos, the meaning, and we have become logoi, or meanings, in him. That is to say, our identity as God conceived of us before the foundation of the world is being fulfilled in Christ. And each one of us, God has patterned in his thought, the final form, if you will, in this thought exercise. And we know that he has that final form, and we are pursuing that final form that he has created for each one of us. That's the meaning, the purpose, the telos of our beings. So that is the answer to this alternative that he's presenting, where we feel like, oh, I'm just a ghost that wears masks. People only love me because of the masks I wear, but if you strip it all away, no one loves me, A, and B, I don't know what I am. So that's where he's going to go with the argument. We as Christians would retort, I do know who I am because my meaning is found in the one who is meaning. It's a legitimate, objective meaning. Just as Christ is the capital W word, I am a small w word, and that word is specific and has an objective meaning, and I am being conformed into that word. So are we all. So that gives that sort of relief to the existential question. Then I know that as a Christian, I'm no longer wearing masks. In fact, it's more like I'm stripping masks off. It's more like I'm finding out who I really am in the light of Christ, and I'm seeking to live ever more fully in him. And even as I lose myself and lose my life, I am really rather gaining my true self and gaining my true life, which are found in him. So Jesus himself talks about this. You can hear some of his own words, some of his own categories in what I'm saying. So, yeah, right, that's the difficulty of this text. It's kind of abstract and it's kind of nebulous. And also, we as Christians have very concrete answers over and against these things. So we're not just lost in the sauce of the vanity. Okay, any other thoughts? Yes, sir.
Mine's just a simple question. What does craved mean by, would you rather be a Catholic or a Kennedy?
Yeah, I don't know. Did you notice I skipped that line?
Ah.
There's a few lines I've intentionally skipped here.
Well,
I assume he has a dim view of Kennedy's.
Yeah, well,
that's my assumption based on just...
My curiosity is also just only vanity if we go more in depth, so...
Right. Yeah. I assume he has a dim view of Kennedy's since he is a Catholic and... That would accord with the logic of the section, but I just didn't. I don't want to render an opinion on that. Yes, sir.
Did Pascal? Do we think that he wrote this when he says "we"? Is he addressing Christians or is he addressing all mankind?
That's part of the difficulty. My working assumption is he's addressing fallen mankind, man in his fallen state, which a Christian can still appreciate within himself on account of the outer man, the sinful nature that still adheres to us. So, I mean, who hasn't, or at least you could exercise your imagination and find some truth to his claims, especially this idea that we're just, I mean, he hasn't developed it fully yet. It gets pretty dark here in a minute. But just this idea that we're ghosts or nothings, meaningless vanities, wisps of smoke, to use the language of the Psalms, that covers itself over in masks to be loved by others, because if we don't have the masks, we won't be loved by others. And in that sense, we will be utterly excluded from the face not only of God, but the face of human beings. That's the point at which Pascal and Kreeft are talking about as being damnation, just a complete isolation and exile from God and man, because man only loves you for what you can provide for him. And then by extension, you'd say, I am nothing, and I am alienated from God. Now I am alienated from man. I am completely on my own. So, yeah, nebulously, generally, abstractly, the fallen man's condition. Yes, sir.
I just have a couple of observations. I think it's interesting that this was written long before social media and then the modern issue that we have today with all the trans issues. That existed way back when.
Sure.
But we've just seen an explosion. It's just exponential now.
Yeah.
Perhaps because of social media that amplifies it,
right,
or it allows it to be amplified. And then the other... I don't have a problem with how you talk to your son or use the word nice. I have a personal issue with that word.
Sure.
I would think that I'm professional and polite and civil
sure.
with the person. I'm every bit nice. They just don't like my niceness.
Sure.
But it helps because, you know, we still face this today. You're pressured and to use preferred pronouns and other such right. nonsense. And you really it really takes a concerted effort to deliberately say, no, I'm not going to do that today. Mm-hmm. Everybody else in my group is calling that person a female. I'm going to say, no, it's a man.
Right.
And I'll do it politely and professionally, but I'm going to stand my ground.
Yeah, yeah. And I think everything you say, I agree with. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not to say that we're mean per se, but they're going to read mean, no matter how polite or nice we are, they're going to read meanness into what we're saying. It's unavoidable. Yeah. Okay, good. Good, good. Let's carry on. Ponce 77 on page 80. Curiosity is only vanity. We usually only want to know something so that we can talk about it. In other words, we would never travel by sea if it meant never talking about it. And for the sheer pleasure of seeing things, we could never hope to describe to others. Then, this is one of my favorite Crafe lines, thus we take vacations only to take pictures. We use reality as a means to the end of producing appearances of it. Yeah. That is that's a wild observation. Okay, so obviously he's on one side of the coin here. I mean this is all provocative. I don't think when he says curiosity is only vanity, I don't think he's actually saying there's not another side to the coin here. But the point he's driving at is that so much of what we do for the sake of others, not actually for the thing itself, right? Okay, so there's a fakeness, a phoniness, a layering, a mask involved in that. Okay, 627, vanity is so firmly anchored in man's heart that a soldier, a rough, a cook, or a porter will boast and expect admirers. And even philosophers want them. Those who write against them want to enjoy the prestige of having written well. Those who read them want the prestige of having read them. And perhaps I who write this want the same thing. Perhaps my readers, .. right? We can say, we have read Pascal and Craved. Have you? Oh, it's such a great book. Yeah. So, Craved is right. There's no escape, no exceptions. Pascal, too, is sucked into the same syndrome he observes, and it's inescapable, it's unavoidable. By observing it only in order to be observed, read, and praised. So am I who observe and read and write about him, so are you who read us. All right, so certainly one side of the coin, but that side of vanity. What would the flip side of this be? That again, some of this is a matter of stewardship, serving your neighbor, but also having the ability to talk with somebody else. I mean, if you're not ever interested in anything or doing anything or experiencing anything or learning anything, how are you going to interact with somebody? So that's the other side of the coin. And I don't think Pascal or Kraft would deny that. I think they're just saying, look at the fallen aspect of these things and how silly they have made us, how vain in every sense of the word. Okay, so I'm going to keep powering on here a little bit, 688, because we're going to get into some heavy stuff. 688, what is the self? A man goes to the window to see the people passing by. If I pass by, can I say he went there to see me? No, for he is not thinking of me in particular. But what about a person who loves someone for the sake of her beauty? Does he love her? No, for smallpox, which will destroy beauty without destroying the person, will put an end to his love for her. which, by the way, is why we exact vows in married couples, so that if this happens, your love has to be deeper. You are publicly and in front of God binding yourself to this duty unto another. Even if smallpox erases the beauty or poverty erases the benefits. Okay, so yeah, here it's already getting a little dark and it's going to get darker. Next paragraph of 688. And if someone loves me for my judgment or my memory, do they love me? Me, myself? No, for I could lose these qualities without losing myself. Where then is this self? It is neither in the body, if it is neither in the body nor the soul. So he's talking about the soul as that which possesses, the memory, the ability to, or the judgment, the rationality, or the ability to remember things. So he's saying those subsist in the soul, whatever. But in any case, the beauty would exist in the body. So where then is this self if it is neither in the body nor the soul? And how can one love the body or the soul except for the sake of such qualities, which are not what makes up the self, since they are perishable? Would we love the substance of a person's soul in the abstract, whatever qualities might be in it? This is not possible, and it would be wrong. Therefore, we never love anyone, but only qualities. Okay, so just let's grab, while we're marinating in that delightful thought, let's grab Kraft, who has a way of amplifying it still further. He says, this is an extremely disturbing thought that perhaps, as Hume and Buddha say, beneath the attributes of the self, there is no substance, that beneath our many masks, there is no face, but only an emptiness that we constantly construct covers for. Even if this is not true, in the end, no one can identify or define the true self. So this is what I was getting at a moment ago. You can't define your true self because who is the you who's defining or knowing yourself? It's circular. How can know thyself is where he's going to go is dumb, because who's the one who knows himself? The you who you already don't know. So you can see the futility of this. Know thyself is an unsolvable puzzle. I mean, he's very polite because he's a philosopher. It's completely dumb and retarded because you can't know yourself. That is a circular proposition. And furthermore, it is only solved by being known. And who is going to objectively know you? Only the one who made you and redeemed you. Only God. And so the only way to know thyself is to know he who made you. And to learn the way that he himself patterned you, and thus to lean into his creation and cooperate, as the Book of Concord would say, in his creation of yourself. So this is the way that Paul speaks, where he encourages the Christians in Ephesus to grow up into the full maturity of the man Jesus Christ. That is to say, we are in process, and the telos is that each one of us would be conformed into the image of Jesus. So knowing these things, then I come to know myself in the only possible way, by something that is external to myself and objective to myself, God. Okay, so we have great answers to this, but if you don't have answers to this, it's bleak and unsolvable. That's the whole point, This is kind of Ecclesiastes mode of theology here from Pascal and Kraft. If you don't have the key, this is just an impenetrable a door, a lock that won't otherwise open. So let's kind of drink in the darkness once more. Know thyself is an unsolvable puzzle. Our universal cone, which is some Japanese paradoxical anecdote, like what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's what a cone is. Okay, for how could the true self, the subject, the I, ever be an object, a that? And if it cannot be an object, it cannot be an object of thought or grasped. I do not know whether or not it was Pascal's settled judgment that we never touch the real self, even in love, or whether he is only throwing out a challenge here. That's my suspicion. A question without an answer. I think it is only a challenge to which true charity is his answer. Otherwise, his praise of charity would be pointless and invalidated by this abyss remaining under it. So would his category of the heart. I think there's a fuller answer in the theology I've been expressing to you, which is in the same way you understand yourself as a logoi from the logos, a small w word after the big W word, you can come to know others in the same way. So, I mean, that in a sense is the pastoral task. Like, how is God working through the blessings and crosses of your life to shape and form you into Christ? How is he taking you, a small w word, or even just a sound, right? A nondescript sound, and forming you into a word, something that has sense and meaning, a name, an identity, that is at the logoi, that is after the logos, that is Christ, the patterning of God's mind, the rationality of God expressed in man. So the word became flesh, Luther says, so that flesh might become word. So that we who are meaningless and just sort of like nondescript sounds in the darkness might be shaped and deformed into meaningful words. That's Luther's theology there in that particular treatment of John's prologue. It's wonderful. Okay, so I think we have deep answers here and deep comfort here, and we also have a way of understanding other people through the same pattern and paradigm. And by the way, this is why only Christians can love. That's what John asserts in his epistle. That's stunning. Only Christians are the ones who can really love. This is a great window into it. Why? Because what is the love of the world? It's not a love of the soul. It's a love of the attributes of the soul. You only love so-and-so because they're beautiful or smart or fun to be around. Or as soon as they become a burden, you lose them as friends. You tuck them away in a nursing home. You forget them. So the world only loves the attributes, not the soul. Christians are the only ones who can love the soul because we recognize that that is what Christ has done for us. Christ has said, I love you in your very nature. That was my sermon last night. I love you in your very nature and essence, stripped of all attributes. If you were completely devoid of intellect, completely devoid of beauty, completely devoid of usefulness, even so I love you, and love you so profoundly I lay down my life for you. That's the only love we have when we're stripped of all things. And isn't death itself, the aging process and death itself, a kind of lesson in this that he gives in varying degrees to varying souls, to be sure? But it's the loss of all your faculties and qualities that make you useful and lovable in your own mind and in the mind of others. And that's a very hopeless, bleak reality. It's one that we spend tons of money and tons of time fighting against, when the answer is that even though I lose all things, still I am loved no differently and no less by the Lord. Now, being loved by him then in this way, we are empowered to love others in the same way, which is why Christians can look past the leprosy and love the inner man. Why Christians can look past the blatant and manifest sins and scandalous reputation and love the soul therein. It's we Christians are uniquely equipped, solely equipped. There's no other people on planet Earth who are capable of this, to love people as they are without inequalities. Make sense? Okay, so that's why John says, I mean, I'm giving a lot of like machinery to something he just puts very elegantly and straightforwardly, that unless you know God, and that is to know the love of God, you cannot love others. Whoever does not know God does not love. Full stop. And you can see now exactly what John means. Okay, yes, let's get some of your thoughts in here.
Wouldn't it be true to say that Christ is the only one that knows us, though? He knows the potential of our attributes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, you only know yourself in his light.
Yeah, I mean...
Otherwise, know thyself is like being in a pitch black night with no sun.
Yeah.
And the sun that is Jesus arises, and it's not just, like, to borrow from C.S. Lewis, it's not just that you see the sun, but it's that you see all things by the sun. And so with the light of Christ shining upon you, you begin to learn and know yourself. And that takes on many forms, doesn't it? Because you get to learn how truly and deeply you're a sinner. You get to know how deeply scarred and twisted your flesh is in specific ways that aren't necessarily common to every single individual, common to all men in general, but not every single individual. You have your own unique scars, your own unique perversions, your own unique sinful nature. You come to know that in his light, but then you also come to know not only his forgiveness, and his light that shines so brightly it blots out your iniquities and reflects back off to the Father. That's all true. But remember Malachi, he rises with healing in his wings. So this light begins to heal you where you start recognizing more and more deeply how sick you are. Even as you're doing that, that light is reaching out to heal you in those very ways. So that is ultimately the medicinal aspect of this whole thing too, is we only know ourselves in light of Christ and what he says about us. And as he enlightens us both to our, you know, to our sins, we're also enlightened in respect to how he's healing us and perfecting us, bringing us into maturity. Do we ever reach that maturity this side of heaven? No. I mean, duh. Right. That should be non-controversial. But that doesn't mean we're not on a path. And it doesn't mean there isn't healing and growth. If you're going to reject that, you're going to reject Malachi, you're going to reject Paul, you're going to reject Christ himself, what he says about these things. Okay, any other thoughts? Okay. So, yeah, I think so. Let's just skip down to 4:13. Anyone who wants to know the full extent of man's vanity has only to consider the causes and effects of love. The cause is a je ne sais quoi, I know not what, and its effects are terrifying. This indefinable something, so trifling that we cannot recognize it, upsets the whole earth, princes, armies, and the entire world. Okay, well, there's one reflection here. Like, if you can remember back to when you were dating, and your girlfriend said to you, what do you love about me? Well, when you put it that way, and all you can think to do is list attributes. But you recognize right away that there's a kind of phoniness, maybe even a kind of flattery in that, and that what really presents you, sorry, I mean, how obnoxious to your girlfriend that you be this philosophical, but what really presents itself to you is, wait a minute, why do I love this person? Or do I love this person? Or do I just love her attributes? Okay, so that is that's why this pensée follows in Crave's mind, and I think it's a good choice. This is the vanity of love. We don't even know why we love, and the reality is kind of cruel. So this is the other side of the coin, that we love, we don't know why we love, and that in and of itself is a kind of mental shield we put up to keep us from the realization that we love attributes as opposed to souls. Okay. Now, he's going to take this in a different direction. The connection is love and attributes, but he's going to go off in this wonderful tangent. So, Cleopatra's nose. What a great start to a sentence. Cleopatra's nose, if it had been shorter, the whole face of the earth would have been different. So an attribute, physical beauty, if something had obscured that beauty, the whole history of the world would be altered. Now that's absurd. But isn't it true? It's true. I mean, think about it, it's true. And he's going to articulate this in more believable ways. But it's the absurdity. So the absurdity of the world is something, of course, postmodernism, for all of its ills, has helped us see very well. And that is that the nature of life, the nature of history are absurd. It is absurd. It's absurd. And to pretend it's otherwise really does a disservice. So again, the answer to this in Christianity, why we don't have to be afraid of this, is because the absurdity or the vanity in the sense in which Ecclesiastes means it, the absurdity, the futility, the ridiculous, often bitter humor of the world is all there is unless you have meaning imposed upon the world. So the same thing with your soul, like I don't know who I am, I only know who I am in Christ, I don't know what the world is or how to make sense of the absurdity unless I have Christ. So this becomes, I don't know who my neighbor is unless I have Christ. So Christ is the sun that enlightens our own souls, the souls of others, and then of course the world, without which everything is vain. There's just ghosts wearing masks. There's chance. There's absurdity. That's all there is. Okay. So Kraft comments very briefly at the bottom of page 82, nothing in the world has such tiny and invisible causes and such great and visible effects as human love. So human love, again, unchained from God, becomes an absurdity and a driver of great absurdities. So no psychologist, top of page 83, no psychologist to this day has ever explained why Romeo falls in love with Juliet. I mean, even the language of fall in love, like when you probe into that. Okay, yet this is literally a matter of life or death. Let us pray that no one ever will explain it. All right. This is in respect to Cleopatra's nose. Because Mark Antony, and you remember these folks are right prior to Christ. Mark Antony's dates are 83 BC to 30 BC. Because Mark Antony would then have not fallen in love with her, fought a war for her, upset the empire, and changed all subsequent history, including ours today. Every one of us is an illustration of the Cleopatra's nose principle. If one of a million sperm cells had not successfully hailed the taxi of your mother's ovum, but another had gotten in instead, you would be a totally different person. If your grandfather hadn't gotten a crick in his neck and turned his head the wrong way one day and noticed your grandmother walking down the street with a pleasing girlish gait, he would never have met her and married her, and you would never have been born. Okay, so there's a kind of absurdity, but only in God do we learn, of course, that God knew us before the foundation of the world, intentionally created us, and there could be no other. So then all of a sudden, what appeared to us once to be absurdity is design. And now the absurdity that often makes us laugh, Cleopatra's nose, or you just happen to see this person and fall in love with them, or the fickleness of the world, actually takes on this other color, that God delights in these things because these are the ways in which he has his way. These are the implausible means that he employs in order to create the very things that he planned to create before the foundation of the world. So then we delight in all of this because we see that it's not absurdity, it's the hand of God. Or rather, maybe both. Okay, so let's just round out this these last comments of Kraft on 83, and then we will open it up for some conversation. No other philosopher has ever so pointedly noticed this common truth that enormous things constantly depend on tiny things. Perhaps this is because most philosophers seldom get their heads out of the comfortable clouds of thought and ideology and look at life as it really is. Cleopatra's nose, Cromwell's kidney stone, flies, the heel of a shoe. What philosopher takes these as his data? Pascal's mind, like his nose, was pointed. Cunning like Machiavelli's. Pascal is Machiavelli converted. All right. So, I mean, this ties in. I don't want to make this lame or banal, but I mean, this ties in with the idea of vocation, though, doesn't it? That the little things matter. Sometimes the little things snowball into big things, but sometimes the little things make profound differences. And you get also, in this sense, the kind of what is it called? I can't remember what it's called. The butterfly wing phenomenon. The butterfly flaps his wings, and then through a series of events, you have a hurricane somewhere in the world, right? Just this idea that little things become big things and coalesce. And so we ought not despise the little things, and we ought not despise our littleness. That's really the theme and thesis. So the whole Christmas story bears that out, because these are little people in a little place that have no bearing on anything, and they're not even footnotes in history, save for the fact that it is God's plan and God's history that is at work in and through them. The same thing really is true for Martin Luther, any other major figure that changes history. By and large, they're just going about their business. They're just doing the little things that God had given them to do. And God says, you know what? That's going to be the little thing that I decide to make giant. Okay, any thoughts you have on this idea or connected ideas? Yes, there's a hand all the way up front here. Yes. Yes, sir.
This is so good because he describes us so well. It makes me think of the song that says, if you want to be happy for the rest of your life, take for yourself an ugly wife. But when you
heard that one.
When you stop and think about it, it's the attributes, that's the chemistry,
yeah,
that causes us to be attracted to someone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has to work first, but I guess the secret is once you get there is, yeah, to say, okay, I see all of this. Now let's evaluate this as far as God is concerned.
Mm-hmm. And
the real stuff.
Yeah, there better be that second analysis. There's a kind of locker room like statement that men have, and that's wherever you see an attractive woman, there's a man who's tired of her. Yeah, it's the same idea, right? Yeah, it's just this reminder that beauty is skin deep and kind of draws the eye, but then there's a person under there, and that person inevitably is a sinner. Yes, please. Or whoever. I'm sorry, I don't know if... right behind you then, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say the ultimate vanity is, I love you because of how I feel when I'm with you and how well you match up to the, yeah, parameters I said I wanted in a person or a mate or a partner. So, you
and
know,
it's
this
inescapable.
Whole thing about vanity is, wow, you really have to let go of all that and just be with somebody.
Yeah, you bring up such a great point, and it's an inescapable point because it's part of our fallen nature. It's just going to happen. We can try to mitigate it or see through it or fight against it as Christians, and yet it's still there. And that's the idea that part of our attraction toward other people, whether it's in a romantic partner, whether it's just in friends, is that they like you and you like being liked. It's just unavoidable. And maybe to kind of jump on the other side for a minute, that's illustrative of how we are actually created. That we are created by God not as individuals, but as members of a larger body. And so baked into our very nature is that we have to have interaction with others. We have to love and be loved. And anything less than that is less than human. It's intolerable to us. So that's a worthy consideration too, that even apart from the fall, it reveals how God constitutes us to love and be loved, and we can't exist in any other reality. That's true. There's the procreative aspect. There's just the social aspect. You have to get along with people. There's no such thing as moving out into the middle of nowhere and just surviving. Nobody can ever actually do that for any amount of time. It's impossible to be truly independent in virtually every way. Yes, sir.
The timing of all this is just amazing, because just yesterday I was at the gym and I was asking this sophomore girl about, like, hey, I need to like use this weight real quick. Whenever you're done, take your time. And then just in the conversation, I mentioned how, you know, I'm a senior, and then she's a sophomore. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, well, when I'm a senior, I'm going to be alone. Like, wait a minute, hold on. There's something here. And so then I felt obligated to tell her this, that we will learn how to be alone, but it's Satan that tempts us with loneliness. There's a difference from being alone to lonely.
Mm, sure.
And so that ties in with what you're saying about we're supposed to get along with others and love others, because we're not meant to be lonely, but we can learn how to be alone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good. And the aloneness is always a reliance upon God, right? And so in that sense, we're never truly alone if we're with Him. That's a kind of baseline. The reality is that it's inescapable. Often what the disease of loneliness is not, it's not actually loneliness. It's a refusal of what God has given, or rather, who God has given. So I run into this all the time. I'm so lonely, Pastor. Well, are there no people around you? Well, there's people around me. Well, then why are you lonely? It's a rejection of the people that God has given. So I'll give you just some snapshots of this, and your mileage may vary. But you go, oh, I'm lonely, I'm disconnected. Do you go to church? I mean, see, it's a rejection of the people that God has given you in your life. So you go, well, I don't like the people. Well, at least you're being honest now. Okay, but it's not that God hasn't given you people. Even when you're immobile in a nursing home bed. I understand how that could be lonely. And yet there are still people. If you can pick up a phone, there's people. There are also workers who are there, and people who are there, doctors and other staff. And those are real people whom God has orchestrated to be in your life at that moment. What can you do to serve them, to help them, to get to know them? So it is, loneliness is very often a kind of something stuck in your eye. It's a problem with your vision, because you can't actually see the people that God has set in front of you and the opportunities that He's providing. And then if you let those scales fall from your eyes, what you'll recognize is I'm despising that which God has given me and desiring something altogether different. Yes, sir.
It seems that boredom is a very close cousin to loneliness.
100%. 100%. It's the same thing. It's something stuck in your perception. Your you're rejecting all the things that God has given you to do, right? Or all the things that God has presented you with.
Especially here in Southern California. You cannot be bored.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, boredom, loneliness, often depression, and many other maladies that we experience are in fact solvable if we simply stop rejecting the opportunity that God has given, the concrete things that God has given. Yeah, that's the reality of it. This is why Jesus asks the man, "Do you want to be healed?" Remember that? There's such a profound exchange. Do you want to be healed? You got, I mean, I read that so many times, and I'm like, why is he asking that? Like, of course he wants to be healed. The man is sitting there by the pool. He's trying to scrape himself into the pool. Obviously, he wants to be healed. But that, I mean, what does being healed mean? It means he's not going to get to lay around by the pool. It means he's going to have to get up and get after it and participate in life and all the responsibilities and burdens and people and everything else. Do you want to be healed is a profound question. And that's the kind of question when you're experiencing like boredom or depression or loneliness or whatever the malady. It's like the realization that there is actually a remedy provided to you right now by God, then the question is, do you actually want the remedy he has provided? Do you want to be healed? And often people, the truthful answer is, no. Then enjoy. I mean, enjoy your self-chosen boredom, loneliness, depression, whatever it is, and don't grouse about it, because at least you're being honest with the Lord and with everyone else that you don't, in fact, want to be healed. Okay, next week let's pick up on page 83, the very bottom, Ponce 750, and let's see if there's a good break or if we're just going to arbitrarily cut it off here. Why don't we say, well, I don't think we'll ever get there, but why don't we say 83 to 95, because that'll give us a clean break, and that'll also kind of end his treatment of, well, it goes from vanity that we're on now into the vanity of human justice and then the vanity of human reason. So we drop into these subsets of vanity. So 83 to, what did we say, 95. The Lord be with you.